So, good afternoon. I'm Alan Fletcher. Welcome to High Notes for the 2016 season. We are in PEPCA Auditorium, and we're also taping this for broadcast on Aspen Public Radio, just so that you know. When we come to the question portion, I will ask you to wait until a person comes to you with a microphone, and that is not so you can be heard in here, but that so you're clearer on the radio broadcast. I do want to mention that I think John Milton would have referred to you as a fit audience, though few, so thank you for being here. And I am joined by Ed Dusenberry. Ed is a marvelous violinist, a longtime member of our faculty in Aspen, in fact, an alumnus of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and for a number of years now, first violinist of the Takash String Quartet, and that is what brings him to Aspen today. This evening, the Takash give a gorgeous program in Harris Hall at 8:30 p.m. But Ed is with us for High Notes, not necessarily to plug the concert, although I've just done so, but to plug this book. This is a newly released book written by Ed Dusenberry from the University of Chicago Press, Beethoven for a Later Age. And I would love to talk about it with you, Ed.
Great, thanks. Nice to be here. Thanks for coming.
So I'm going to start by making reference to just a sort of scattershot number of anecdotes. As you see, it's not a hugely large book. However, I found that every single page had some story or observation that just stopped me and made me want to think about it for a while. And even in some cases, maybe this sounds too nerdy, now go to my office and pick up, you know, Thayer's Life of Beethoven or something and remind myself of something. So it was a really, really wonderful experience that I had reading this book. If we tell 30 fabulous stories in the course of this hour, we will have barely touched the number of things in the book. But I thought I would start with a rather younger Ed Dusenberry. You came from the UK to the US to study, and as I said, studied in Aspen part of that time, also at the Juilliard School. Would you tell us the story of how Dorothy DeLay helped connect you with the Takash Quartet?
Well, that connection very much had to do with Aspen, because she was friends with someone on the board then, Faye Schrader, who lived in Denver, and was also very very involved in the music scene in Boulder at the University of Colorado. And so when the Hungarians were looking for a new first violinist, they asked her for advice, and she kindly recommended me. I was then her student at Juilliard. And so that was kind of the door opening, and then that led to an audition.
But you were, I think, very young at the time.
I was 24, and I think the only thing that I have to be very thankful to the violinist and now conductor, Peter Ungen, who had also been a student of Dorothy DeLay's and joined the Tokyo Quartet at a similar age to me. So when our cellist, Andrash, asked DeLay, well, don't you think Ed's too young? And she said, well, Peter Ungen, you know, is the first violinist of the Tokyo Quartet, and that worked out very well. So I think that was lucky for me.
Well, and there's some parallels in that the Tokyo Quartet was four Japanese musicians who then lost their first violinist and chose Peter, who is Canadian. And the Takash Quartet was four Hungarian string players who had been extraordinarily close since their student days, I think, and then Mr. Takash himself is the one who left, and they brought in you.
And when I talked with Peter, I think sometime after joining the quartet, we were joking about how it affects a quartet when you have to change language, and it was rather an opposite experience. So he said that his Japanese colleagues, when they had to rehearse in English, they actually found that they could be less polite to each other. Whereas for my Hungarian friends, it was rather the opposite. For a little while, until I introduced them to some choice terms, they found that they had to be a bit too polite. And so during that first year, if things ever got a bit heated, they would immediately go back into Hungarian.
Well, I already knew the Takash well, except it was with you. I didn't know them before you. At a time when you had a different change of personnel, and Jerry Walther came into the quartet. Would you talk some about, well, if you wish to give one of the many stories about you integrating into the quartet, that'd be great. But then I want to take it forward a number of years to now you're helping Jerry integrate.
Well, you know, when Jerry joined, it was a very different situation. Obviously, she had many, many years of performance experience, whereas I just jumped in as a student. But she was, and the change for her was that she was coming from the world of orchestral musicians to chamber music. And one of the elements of that is that when you're on the road with an orchestra, there's always someone to go and have dinner with. And so one of the aspects we had to change was that as a quartet, and quartets are different, but we had evolved to a situation where if we had a free evening, we would not be having dinner with each other. It was just one of those kind of healthy ways to keep a little bit of space. And so the first time we went away with Jerry, we had a rehearsal day, we got to the end of the rehearsal, and she asked, "So who's having dinner with me?" And there was this shocked silence. And so we did then kind of change things around, and for about the first 18 months or so, we did then spend more social time with each other. But we felt that she became quickly a seasoned quartet member. And so after about a year, the question had changed a little bit after the rehearsal or before the rehearsal. She would ask one of us, "If I don't get a better offer, can I have dinner with someone?" So.
Now, it leads me to a question about this evening, because one of your colleagues is temporarily indisposed, and you had to make a decision as a quartet whether to fulfill your summer engagements with someone who would be invited in, or conceivably to just cancel, or conceivably to appear as a solo violinist, a solo violist, or a string trio or something. So how did you make that decision, and how has it gone?
Well, and this happened about probably 10 or 11 years ago when András, our cellist, was out for just a few weeks. And in that particular case, we sort of did a mixture of... We did a sonata evening, basically, with the wonderful pianist here, Anton Nell. This time, it's rather different because we have at the University of Colorado... two wonderful violinist colleagues who are on the faculty there, Charles Weatherby and Hirumi Rhodes, and they both have tons of chamber music experience, and especially quartet experience. So when this came up, when we knew that Carrie would have to be out just for a month or 2 months or so, then that was immediately our first thought, particularly as this is a wonderful program this evening. And so Charles is... It's been actually a joy working with him. We've been working for about a week, but he knows the repertoire very well, and he knows the kind of the way that a string quartet interacts. And of course, we know him personally, and we've played Mendelssohn Octet with him before, and this kind of thing. So that was it was a very easy choice in this particular case.
Excellent. Well, we are looking forward to it. That is again 8:30 this evening in Harris Hall. We, over the past couple of years, I don't know why, but we've been talking a lot about people's instruments, the difference between an early, middle, or late Strad, or the different Guarnerius, or between Guarnerius and Strad, or between Vuillaume and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You had a sort of ruefully comic story about a time when you were playing on a group of Amati instruments, and it has to do with a review of one of those concerts.
That's right. Well, this was a so-called matched set of instruments by Niccolò Amati that were owned by the Corcoran Gallery, and they kindly lent them to us. In fact, matched doesn't... I mean, it's not that the maker put them together as a quartet, and they weren't all by Niccolò Amati, and they actually all sounded quite different to each other. But on this particular tour, and we always said in our biography that we play on this set... On this particular tour, the cello was actually being repaired, and András was playing a very nice instrument by the modern maker, Christopher Dungy. And the review of the concert talked in quite lyrical terms about how wonderful the matched set of instruments sounded together. So people believe what they read.
But then a certain time after that, you lost the chance of using those instruments, and then you had a real decision, both as individual players and as a quartet, about getting new instruments to play, and it has a happy ending.
Yeah, and again, thanks to this wonderful woman, Faye Schrader, who was a friend and introduced me to the quartet, and she very kindly decided, when she knew about our problem, to help us buy instruments, and so her foundation bought instruments. For me, it was a kind of rude introduction to that heady world of violin dealers and very expensive prices, and I felt very much out of my league when I sort of showed up to these fancy showrooms with their sort of fancy carpets and pictures of Isaac Stern and Yehudi Menuhin on the wall and dealers wearing their suits. And I was a little bit intimidated because I didn't really know anything about violins. But I noticed that they all had a way of holding an instrument with the scroll and also at the base and sort of rotating it kind of like this. And looking very authoritative. So I spent quite a lot of time doing that myself. But unfortunately, my cover was blown. I tell this story in the book because one of the things you're very worried about with older instruments is their condition. Obviously, you know, any instrument that's good but that old has had damage. So you're sort of looking and trying to see the damage. And I was quite pleased with myself because I found a crack that went down the whole of the back of this instrument that had been well repaired. It was a very regular looking crack. But I said to this particular dealer, it's been very well repaired, that crack. And he said, that's a two-piece back, which is the most usual type of back on an instrument. So I was pretty embarrassed. He was very nice about it. But
what are you playing now? And I do like the story about your patron and her family's help.
Yes, well, so they sort of, we selected some instruments, and then they came to Boulder and heard us play them. But the whole thing was unbelievably low key. When you think that our whole sort of careers and livelihood were at stake. And when she eventually decided to get an instrument for me, it was really like she was just sort of offering to buy me a cup of tea or something. Unbelievably low-key. And afterwards, the only sort of demand that she made of us was that we should go and play a house concert at her house every year. And actually, it was that experience of playing house concerts for her that was very important to me in getting settled in the quartet, because, of course, a lot of chamber music originated in those type of conditions.
I want to turn to a category of anecdote with which the book is generous, but about how you rehearse. Things you say to each other in a rehearsal and how that works. Sometimes things you say to each other after a concert. I thought I would start with, sorry to remind you of this, a little mishap you had in Opus 59, number 2 of Beethoven.
I don't remember that at all. So the end of Opus 59, number 2, it's a very, very exciting last movement, which is anyway going quite fast enough. And then there's a prestissimo, and, adrenaline was pumping a bit. I made that classic mistake of kind of thinking that the concert had gone really well before it was over. So with about 30 seconds to go, I suddenly got completely lost. And there was no real way to quite recover because the music was going on so fast and the chords changing so quickly. And my poor colleagues who, you know, bear in mind that they were very alert to the fact that I was inexperienced playing a lot of new repertoire. And so they were very keen, if they felt any insecurity, to jump and follow me. But it was a bit difficult to work out what I'd done exactly. So one of them would jump a couple of bars ahead, another one went back a couple of bars, and it was total atonal mayhem. We just about managed a last chord together. And what was great about the Hungarians, this was back in 1994 that this happened, was that as we stood up to bow, they were just all laughing incredibly hard. And so there was no sense of kind of recrimination or like, you know, how could you? And the thing is, not only was it the end of the concert, it was the end of the music festival. It was the last piece to be performed at this music festival. So that was a good learning experience. And actually, when I get to this day, when I turn over the last page of a piece, a little part of me goes, concentrate, because of that experience.
Well, you observe in the book, apropos of that same incident, that as a threshold condition for excellent chamber playing, you should try to end at the same time. So I'm just going to tell a quick personal story, which is a total digression, but it involves Bobby McDuffie, so I feel it's, you know, apt somehow. I think you would have been a student at Juilliard after I was.
Yes.
Because it was after Bobby as well, and Bobby and I were there at the same time.
Yes.
But I was the pianist for the contemporary ensemble. This was the absolute opposite of being an honor. It was that no real pianist at Juilliard would ever consent to do that. For one concert, Bobby was the concertmaster, and that was also a bit of a head-scratcher because he was one of the star violinists in the school. But it turned out Miss DeLay had made a deal that if he would play a concertmaster for the contemporary ensemble on one throwaway event, he could be excused from the orchestra for, you know, much more work. So we were doing a new piece. I won't say the composer because I have to conceal a lot about this story. And it had gone terribly. We had never even run the piece in any rehearsal. We had never played through any major section of the piece. We had a conductor who could not beat time. But we weren't too worried because we'd play. And at the last minute, we found out that Alberto Ginastera was in town, and he was the closest friend of this composer, and they were coming, and therefore the president of the school, who never showed up at those things, was coming. And the New York Times were sending a reviewer, which happened in those days at a student concert. And so we were in a panic. We started this piece, and I had a solo right near the beginning, which I had that day memorized because of all that stuff. So I played my solo, and I was so happy. It went really well. And then I realized I had just stopped counting. And I had no idea what was happening. There was no chance the conductor would cue me at any time. So towards the end of the piece, I had a huge triple fortissimo chord. So I just waited for a while and then played it. And Bobby McDuffie from across the stage as a concertmaster went like this because he had the chord in his part as a cue, and we were many measures away from it, but he just went and he jumped to that spot. And then sooner or later, everybody had a cue, and we ended this brilliant thing all together. So
it's a great story.
You make a very striking observation. I think it was also about Opus 59, number 2, although my notes don't say that, about a Beethoven mid-period quartet, in any case, where you wish to convey emotional instability, and you wish for it to be very fragile and contingent, I might say, but your rehearsal process was to put on the metronome and just lock everything in. So to convey instability, you practice much, much harder. And then you comment that you were worried that it would become unspontaneous in that way.
Yes. That's with the same piece, the first movement of Opus 59, number 2, which is a very, it's a fleeting piece with tremendously fast changes. And I suppose that was all part of realizing this huge difference on stage that, on the one hand, it's me as a person playing, but actually, like an actor, I have a particular role to play, and so I can convey in the role of an actor instability in the music, but I can't actually feel unstable myself, and it's a very, very important distinction for any performing artist, and so yeah, that's exactly how we worked on it. You, in order to be spontaneous on stage, you have to kind of build up the the tools, the security and the stability, the confidence in what you're doing, and then you can experiment afterwards.
Now, so the book has a lot of great stories about life in a quartet, a lot about travel, which I think I might skip for now, but they're really good. However, it's also organized around the quartets of Beethoven and around Ed's lifetime experience of engaging with the full Beethoven cycle the first time, maybe the second time, maybe the third time. And now the book is just saturated with observations. That's a good thing. I could have said drenched. That would have been
that's right, yes.
Not as good.
Suffocated by it.
But it is organized around quartets. And I would highly recommend that you buy it, A. I think it's at Explore. It is University of Chicago Press, if you need to go online to find it. But that you have a Takács set of recordings of the Beethoven. And then if you want to get even more elaborate, have someone else's too, I think. It is the kind of experience that you'll want to just have layers and layers like that. So let's talk a little about Beethoven. And maybe first with, is it the Opus 18 F major that you talk about a lot?
I do. Maybe just before that, just to explain a little bit about the genesis of the book. But for me, always the interest was there's some kind of personal story that I want to tell, but how can I structure it in a way that I can go jump back and forth between the stories of the first players and the first audiences? And that, for me, was the interest to make what on paper might be a rather problematic hybrid. And it was a funny process because I was very lucky to work with a literary agent who I knew in London. And when I sent early stuff to her, she looked at me and said, "Ed, you're not famous enough to write a memoir. And there's too many stories about your grandma. Stick to the historical stuff and the process of, you know, working in a quartet." So I did head that way, and I think I did leave out any mention of my grandma, which is a shame because they were good stories. And then when Faber acquired the book and I first had the meeting with the editor, she said, "More personal stuff, more stories." So, and that actually went the whole way through the process. I felt like I was on this sort of fence just trying to balance the two different elements. And that was a lot of the fun of it for me, actually. Sorry that didn't answer your question, but...
Well, let's stay with Beethoven here. I feel that we have a very knowledgeable audience, yeah. But in case someone listening doesn't know, Beethoven, there are certain genres, maybe four or five sets, that go through his whole life. That is, he wrote some cello sonatas as a quite young man. He then wrote some cello sonatas as a middle-aged person, and then he wrote some cello sonatas representing his great late period. And the same can be true of violin sonatas. The same is obviously true of symphonies, piano sonatas, because there are more piano sonatas than anything else. But then the quartets. And the quartets, I feel, are one of the most beautiful expressions of his growth and change in his life, and they do come in sort of chunks. So if you don't mind filling us in.
Well, to get back to you, you asked a question about Opus 18 number 1 in F major, which is one of the six Opus 18 quartets that he wrote in 1798-1799, his first serious works. And that's a particularly interesting piece because it wasn't actually the first that he composed, but it's such an effective piece he decided to publish it as the first of the set. But in any case, he wrote a version of it and dedicated it to a friend and sent it to the friend. And then a couple of years, maybe within a year, he'd revised it so much in his mind that he wrote to the friend and said, "Don't show that to anyone. You know, I've written a newer version, and since I wrote that first version, I've learnt how to write string quartets." Which is, it's a very dramatic thing to say. So in doing the research for the book, I was keen to kind of look at the differences and find out what was so dramatically different. And there are a number of scholars who've written about this. There's a whole monograph that's about that thick that studies the differences. But I'm embarrassed to say that I didn't notice so many dramatic differences. They're small things they have to do sometimes with the distribution of parts, maybe to make the second violin, the viola, more interesting or more telling. There are a few structural things, but I mean the basic shape is quite similar. Some of the changes are to do with the way he marks the tempo, the slow movement. Instead of just an adagio, it says it should be a appassionato as well, and a fettuoso, with a lot of feeling. So in that case, he's asking the performers to do more with the character. But what I came away from was that in his own mind, there was this dramatic process of evolution and change that he associated with string quartets. And even if I couldn't see that the changes were that dramatic, that was how he set off, and he never changed from that. So you can see, for example, in the third movement of that piece, a bit where in the trio section, where the first violinist kind of goes up in smoke, it's just suddenly very, very fast and virtuosic. And you see him many years later coming back to that idea, 1824, Opus 127, the same idea. This time the whole quartet goes nuts at that time. And certainly he, I'm sure, had the first example in his mind.
Well, it's a interesting, I think, endearing thing about Beethoven. A person who started as a teenager was already writing masterpieces, but was preoccupied with making something new and with exploring new territory. So within the Opus 18, which we now look back on as entirely a first period work, he is saying, oh no, I found something totally new and very important. The Opus 31 piano sonatas, he said, finally I have written something genuinely different. Then you come to Opus 59, which is the middle group, part of the middle group of Beethoven quartets, and it's really something. And I think you take your title from one of his comments about that.
That's right. Well, there was a rather rude violinist who said to Beethoven about the Opus 59s, it's not music. And to him, Beethoven replied, they are not for you, they are for a later age. So Beethoven was quite uncompromising about that. But in fact, that later age came quite soon, and part of my interest in the book was talking about some of the patrons. I have mentioned our wonderful patron, Faye Schrader. Beethoven also had patrons who were very important, and Count Razumovsky, who commissioned the Opus 59s, probably as a direct reaction to seeing how difficult they were, instead of saying, well, they're not music, he engaged probably one of the first professional string quartets in residence at his palace, specifically so that they could have the rehearsal time to work on this music. And so it was almost because of that that then these pieces actually became more accepted quite quickly, because the conditions for rehearsal were so much better.
But some of those same players, encountering some of the later quartets, actually thought Beethoven was joking, that he was making fun of them, and that he didn't really intend that music to be played.
Yes, I mean, and there was that's absolutely true, and there was a cellist who was particularly scandalized by the opening of one of the mid-quartets, where it's the opening of 59 number 1, where he just plays on his own this rhythm, da-da-dum-dum-da-da-dum-dum-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, so no melody. And this particular cellist, as the anecdote goes, just threw his music up in the air and stamped on it, and felt that this was an insulting way to treat a cellist. And I think it must have been a very difficult balance for these players, because it was at a time, not that long, you know, just 30 years previous, they might have been more likely to be in the service of an aristocrat like Prince Esterhazy. But now they were more moving into the freelance way of being. And so they would be keen to have music that would show off their strengths, show off their virtuosity. And Beethoven was doing that. But of course, the flip side of that is if it's too difficult, then you make a fool of yourself. And that also happened to the violinist Ignaz Schuppensich when they first played Opus 127. And so that was that sort of fine line, pieces that could make you look really good, or they could make you look really bad.
Well, I'd like to talk some about patronage and Beethoven, and first, just an observation. One of his two or three most important patrons during his life, well, to go back to what you said about Esterhazy, at Esterhazy, Haydn and his orchestra had to wear liveries that marked them as servants, and that everybody would understand. It's sort of the opposite of wearing white tie in a concert. It's to be set apart that way. Obviously, Beethoven felt pretty strongly about this, and there's a possibly apocryphal story, but it's told in many of the biographies, about him at a spa that he liked to go to at Baden, and the emperor was there, and Beethoven was actually meeting, I think for the first time, Goethe, and they had known each other by reputation. So they're walking down a pathway, and all of a sudden they realize the emperor and empress and whole entourage are coming the other way, and they will need to step off the path to let them go. So Goethe steps off the path, and Beethoven just stands there. And finally, the entourage has to shuffle around him. And after they're gone, Goethe says, like some version of, "Are you a madman? That was the emperor." And Beethoven says, "It is for them to stand aside." So, anyway.
I think that he, you know, Beethoven was a very proud man, and he, with one of his first patrons, Prince Lichnowsky, when Beethoven first went to Vienna, Lichnowsky was very helpful in both helping him meet musicians, promoting his music, and giving him a place to stay at first. But even then, Beethoven found it quite difficult for his pride, and so apparently when Lichnowsky offered Beethoven to use one of his horses, the next day Beethoven hired his own horse, this type of thing, and he preferred really not to have to eat with the family because that involved shaving and kind of etiquette. He'd rather just go out to the local tavern. And, I mean, in a mild way, I must say when I joined the quartet at age of 24, I had, you know, you spend many hours in a practice room here, also at Aspen, and you kind of feel like it's just about excellence. And as when I joined the quartet, it took me a while to realize that that's true, but that's just the beginning. And one of the great things about playing in a string quartet is the relationships that you develop with people, and with sometimes with donors, with friends that you develop over the years, like Faye Schrader. But I must say, at first, that was an adjustment for me to realize that you're not just working in a bubble. You actually are part of a social organism.
So Lichnowsky was one of the great patrons. Razumovsky, who Ed has mentioned, was another. He was an ambassador, or at least part of the time, had the rank of ambassador from Russia to Vienna. But he wasn't really originally a Russian aristocrat at all, was he? There's a sort of startling story about this.
Yeah, it's such a strange story that actually he came from a family in rural Ukraine, but his uncle was a talented singer and was heard by one of the courtiers who was passing through and hired him to join a choir in St. Petersburg. And from there he was spotted by Elizabeth, not Tsar, clearly, but she was, I guess, queen. And she liked quite a lot more than his voice. And so they probably got married, although that's not entirely clear. And as a result, the whole family was elevated in terms of status. And so Count Razumovsky grew up in that kind of court environment, very ironically, because of initially of the talent of his uncle's voice. Mm-hmm.
And this in an era where it was probably not unknown to everybody what his origins were. But he became immensely wealthy and built one of the most splendid palaces in all of Vienna, and then set up the string quartet on behalf of Beethoven. And then where does it go from there?
Yeah, I mean, his story was the thing that actually first really excited me of all the things to do with Beethoven when I was studying. And I mentioned in the book, one of the reasons I studied the history was I felt so unconfident when I joined the quartet, working with three guys who had 18 years of performing this music. I thought, well, at least I can read as much as I can and sort of find out some extra information. even if it, who knows how it will help. And so the story of Razumovsky, first of all, he was a diplomat, he was an ambassador during the that very turbulent time, Napoleonic Wars, and then by the time of the Congress of Vienna came round, he'd been fired, but he was still a very important social figure. And then he was this great patron of the arts. And he was a very ambitious man. He really wanted to be totally at the top of Viennese society. And he was therefore like a lot of Beethoven's patrons who, during the straitened circumstances of the Napoleonic Wars, they sort of tried to maintain this very glamorous lifestyle, which was way beyond their means. So you're right that he started off very wealthy, but already by the Congress of Vienna, he was way out of his depth. And then there was this catastrophe struck, and his palace was in a, it was a very bad fire at the palace on New Year's Eve, I think 1814. And much of the manuscript collection and the sculptures and a lot of his valuable possessions were burnt down. The palace was very badly damaged, and he never recovered from that. That sort of finished him off. And it seems it's very ironic to me that he had all these life ambitions to be famous and well-known, and probably at this point the only reason we really pay him attention is because of these quartets that he commissioned.
And I think it's not settled whether he suggested the Russian themes or whether Beethoven, as a nice tribute, incorporated two Russian folk songs into the quartets.
That's exactly right. Some people would say that he asked for them, but there's no documentary evidence. Some people think it's unlikely that Beethoven would have been so polite as to include Russian folk themes just out of niceness. Equally, you could say that he wouldn't have done them under duress either. So we never know. But in any case, he found two themes, and he only managed to do it in two of the three quartets. In the third one, there's very recent research that's actually been published since I wrote the book that traces a connection in the slow movement of the other piece to some kind of Russian source as well. But I think, in a way, it doesn't really matter how he got there. It was at that time, which is described so vividly in War and Peace, when the Austrian and Russian armies were so heavily defeated at the Battle of Austerlitz in 1805. So exactly the time that he was working on this piece in Vienna, the first French occupation, wounded soldiers of different nationalities in the streets. So it would have been on his mind, themes of Russian patriotism and Austrian patriotism. And so it's kind of a nice and much more effective alliance between Count Razumovsky, the Russian ambassador, and Beethoven, Austria's most famous composer at that point, somewhat more successful alliance than the two armies.
I'm going to tell a long story, and the point of it at the end, just so you can anticipate, is to ask you about speaking from the stage, or speaking with an audience, perhaps before a concert or in some other way. In a sense, this book is a brilliant way to share a musician's observations about the music in a way that you might read, and then we have a Beethoven quartet on the program this evening, and I think you might have time this afternoon if you run to explore it. But there are other recordings. So I was once asked by a very great string quartet I will not mention, and it's not the Emersons or Takash, you'll guess, but I was a very, very young professor in Boston, and they were giving the Beethoven cycle on a national tour, but it was a year-long project. So they were going to make a swing through a number of cities doing their first program, and then make a swing doing their second program. And how many programs do you do for the Beethoven cycle?
We do it in six, which means that you play one of the late quartets twice, and the reason for doing that is, again, going back to Beethoven's process, that he wrote Opus 130 with the phenomenal and challenging Grosse Fuge as a last movement, and then for a variety of reasons which I go into in the book, he wrote an alternative last movement which is very, very different in its mood, and so we play 130 with the fugue at the end of our first concert, no, with the alternative at the end of our first concert, and then with the fugue at the end. So if you do it that way, you can do six concerts.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, it was our first round. As I recall, it was Opus 18, number 1, and then it was Opus 95, and then it was Opus 135, so F major, F minor, F major, and early and middle-ish, and then late. And they wanted me to do a pre-concert lecture. So they made a mistake, because for the first one, City, they just said, make it about half an hour and, you know, go crazy. So I did, and one of the members, it turns out, came and sat in the back of the hall, and afterwards the party said, thanks so much for that lecture. You know, it was a little dry. And I said, well, really? Because I thought it was okay. And he said, no, it was very, very excessively theoretical. And I said, no, really? Because I just thought I was talking about the key relationships. And he said, yeah, you know what people like is recordings. So you didn't play actually any examples. So please do some examples. All right, next city, same guy comes back at the party and says, okay, better. But people really like to compare recordings. So don't just play one excerpt. If you're talking about 135, play a couple of different quartets and show something about them. I said, okay, that doesn't really fit my talk at all. He said, yeah, it doesn't, does it? But do it that way. So by the end of the tour, I was exclusively playing recordings and saying, here's Quartetto Italiano, and you will notice this. And then here is the Juilliard Quartet's first round of recording this, and you'll notice this. And that was my entire talk. There was no theory, there was no history, there was nothing. And our last concert was in Boston. And so I'm standing backstage, ready to go out, and I see Lewis Lockwood, who was then chairman of the music department at Harvard, and president of the International Beethoven Society and one of the most renowned Beethoven scholars in the world, and I know him very well. And there he was sitting next to him, Alan Tyson, who was the past president of the International Beethoven Society, and then a few rows away was Leon Kirchner, one of the greatest living composers at the time, and then horrifyingly in the front row was Gunther Schuller, and they were all there to hear my talk, which was so dumbed down. And then, as I was about to walk out, the stagehand said, oh, I'm sorry, we didn't set up the CD player, so you can't play any CDs. And my entire talk was CDs, so I had to improvise the previous talk in front of that audience.
It's a fabulous story. I think you missed the trick there. I think after a couple of concerts when this annoying quartet player was giving you feedback, you should have said to him, you know, I noticed a couple of mistakes you made in the first piece. Maybe instead of listening to my pre-concert lecture, you better spend some time warming up.
Okay, I'm actually still friends with that guy. I'm going to call him up right now. But now, don't be alarmed. I have to leave. Part of my duties as president of the festival are to be at board meetings, and we have a board meeting today at 1 p.m. So, however, I turn the stage over exclusively to Ed, maybe to talk a little about how you speak with an audience and what you think is helpful, and maybe in a few moments to ask you if you have questions or comments. So, thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Well, that was yet another thing that I wasn't prepared for when I joined the Tokash Quartet, was this idea of talking to audiences. Back then, groups weren't doing it so much. And my first experience was when we went to Australia, and the promoter there said, who was organizing the whole tour, said it's very important that you talk, but we don't like it when performers talk about the music, because sometimes it gets too dry. So we need something a little bit more. It can be related to the music, but it needs to be more personal. At first, the Hungarians in the group pleaded their lack of English, so I had to do it. But as we've evolved, although I'm sort of most often the person who talks, I actually like the occasions if we do a sort of a more informal lecture recital. It's actually much more interesting when they can hear everyone talk. But I'd be interested if anyone has any comments or feedback about this. It's still a slightly contentious issue. Just recently we played for a series and I introduced the Janáček Quartet Intimate Letters, which has a very strong autobiographical story. It's a sort of obvious thing to talk about. And the promoter was really outraged afterwards. He said to me, it's very patronizing to the audience and it spoils the music because then it spoils the element of surprise. So I guess I won't be talking there anymore. But on the whole, people tend to like it. I think more in England, it's still a little bit tricky. It's a little bit more formal there. Who knows what Brexit will have an effect on that. But anyway, so yeah, I mean, I enjoy talking and try to keep it about something personal to do with our rehearsal process, and that's what I got into when I was writing the book. Anyway, I feel like I've been talking a lot, so if there are any questions, anything you'd like to ask, please do. Just put up a hand and then wait for the microphone.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Dusenberry. I'm curious to hear a little bit about your musical life outside the quartet, if it's teaching or playing with a pianist or playing a solo concerto, and what role, if any, that has had in your quartet playing and possibly vice versa.
Yeah, this is a good question. For my experience, and it's not the same for all quartets, but the position of being in the Tokács Quartet has been quite full-time for me, partly because of the circumstances under which I joined it. I couldn't really swan around playing sonatas when I had 30 new quartets to be learned every season. But of course, being in a string quartet involves a lot more than just performing, and you mentioned teaching. We've been in residence at the University of Colorado, the group, since 1986 in Boulder, and that it may be, perhaps with the exception of the Juilliard Quartet, the longest relationship between a quartet and a university. We love it there, and our position there has evolved over the years so that we teach. We have a graduate quartet program there, a very intensive program. Group comes to work with us. And you mentioned how do those elements affect my own playing. Certainly having another group on campus that's really trying to do what we're doing, that's their career goal. It keeps us on our toes because they can kind of see, are we actually doing what we're telling them about? And it leads to kind of amusing situations. Sometimes I'll see a first violinist playing a very, very different bowing from what I do, and I'll ask him why, and he said, well, I heard you play it the other night, and maybe I'll do something different. So, you know, so that kind of thing. So it's really important for me to find things outside of the quartet, but not things that take up too much energy. And I think that's really where the book writing project came from, because it arose out of my work in the quartet, but it's a very, very different kind of thing. So it was actually, I think, really sort of a healthy time for me when I was working on it, although my family might possibly disagree with that statement. It's a good question. I do the occasional concerto, occasional sonata and violin, piano, and love doing that repertoire as well.
Could you tell us what the role of the second violinist is in the quartet in relation to the first violinist?
Yeah, I'm sorry that we don't have our second violinist here to share that. I'll try and tell that, but to tell a silly story first. We were teaching at the Guildhall School of Music many years ago. It was an early morning coaching, and the second violinist didn't show up. So I said, well, that's no problem. I'll teach and I'll play second violin as well. It was a disaster. I mean, I had no idea how incredibly difficult it is to play second violin, because, I mean, anyone in a quartet is changing their roles back and forth all the time. You have to sometimes match with the first violin, sometimes with the viola, sometimes with the cello. Suddenly you're a soloist. And somehow I feel like you have to keep taking off and putting on those hats much more frequently. Anyway, at the end of this particular session, while I was playing second violin in this group and trying to teach them at the same time, the first violinist turned to me and said, "Don't call us, we'll call you." So
Welcome to Aspen. Nice to have you here. I wonder if you might share with us some insights into the Shostakovich Quartet we're going to hear tonight. Thank you.
So we're going to be playing Shostakovich's third string quartet. And it's a wonderful piece that was written around the end of the Second World War. And it's got quite an interesting history because it starts with, it has a title for each movement that Shostakovich introduced for the first concert. And roughly translated, the first movement is calm unawareness of future catastrophe. Sounds like Shostakovich, yeah? Second movement, rumblings of unrest. Third movement, the forces of war unleashed. Fourth movement is a kind of memorial to the dead. And the fifth movement title, the eternal question, why and what for, which I don't think refers to the very long cello solo that starts that piece. But then he withdrew those titles right away after the first performance. So the context is that Shostakovich was under a lot of pressure. The government wasn't happy with the recent symphonies that he'd written, Stalin's regime. He had, in their opinion, he wasn't writing music that was sufficiently heroic and victorious. And the emotional trajectory of this piece, as you can tell from the titles, is that it starts off sort of rather naive, innocent, and it becomes incredibly sad. It's one of the most beautiful endings, I think, of any string quartet I know. And it seems to me that he may have put those titles in to try and deceive the government. This is not my idea, by the way, but I read it and think it's convincing. To think that he was writing about the Second World War. And in fact, he, like many of the artists, were quite in despair about the situation in Russia after the war. And it's more likely, I think, that he was reflecting that general mood. So the titles are interesting. It didn't deceive the government because the regime still found it to be too bleak a piece, whatever the subject material. And so then it wasn't played for very many years. But we love playing it because it has such a variety of moods to start something so naive and innocent that in a bizarre way comes quite nicely out of the fresh, cheerful Opus 18 quartet that we're playing to start with, and then just gradually goes down and down. I think we've got time for one more question, if anyone has one. Anyone?
Thank you. When you're playing Beethoven quartets, for instance, that have a long tradition that have been performed by many other ensembles, do you want to find a fresh approach, something new and different? And there's four of you in the Takash Quartet. So do you end up with four fresh approaches? And if so, how do you resolve that?
Yeah, in one word, that's rehearsing. So, yes, I mean, one's always very aware of the tradition. I grew up with the Amadeus Quartet's recordings. Certainly, I loved the Guarneri Quartet's recordings, Alban Berg. I mean, there are actually too many to name great recordings out there. The funny thing is that when you sit down, what you said is that four people, any four people in a room, if you give it enough time, those four people will come up with their own version. And that's the great thing, is particularly about these pieces. They seem to be so full of possibilities. So especially the late quartets, if you listen to four or five recordings, they're incredibly different to each other. So one doesn't really have to worry about doing something new, per se. You just, within the group, you kind of work. And maybe for us, it's even more important, just like actors who might... I remember reading about Ian McKellen, who went on a world tour as King Lear, and he performed King Lear for 8 months in a row. And in a way, we don't ever do a marathon like that. But between us on stage, we're thinking, well, how might tonight be a little bit different from how it was the previous night? And that's to do with kind of small details, often character changes, that sort of thing. Anyway, I think we're just about out of time. So thank you so much for coming. Enjoyed the conversation, enjoyed the questions as well. Thanks.